Good evening. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight is bail reform and money bail. My guests in the studio tonight need little introduction. Corinne Rankin is the former president of the California Bail Agents Association. While Corinne's recently left the industry, she has a wealth of institutional knowledge, and at this time is speaking to us with no stake in the game. We have sitting to her right is Jeff Adachi, the public defender of San Francisco, whose office is spearheading the issue of bail reform in California. And to her left is Steve Wagstaff, San Mateo County District Attorney and past president of the California District Attorneys Association. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, it is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Welcome. I'd like to welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights. And I'd like to start with this. Corinne, why don't you start us out and tell us just what is bail?
Well, first, let me just, I just want to make a statement. I was actually former chair of the board of the California Bail Agents Association. So there is still a president, and she's still there. What is bail? Bail is insurance, by definition. I was a licensed insurance agent for over 15 years. I was a bail insurance agent. What bail is it's an insurance policy that someone purchases, and it insures their appearance in court.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about the history of bail. Do you want to take that, Steve? Get us started?
Well, sure. It's a constitutional principle, both in the United States Constitution in the Eighth Amendment and in California. And in the California Constitution, there is a right to bail. It has always existed, and the purpose was, of course, to guarantee a person's appearance in court was the original purpose of it. In a number of many years ago, back in 1982, the voters passed Proposition 8, which provided an additional aspect to it, and that is for public protection. And at that point, they it provided there in both Prop 8 and in a different initiative, Article 1, Section 12 was passed, which said that courts in setting bail may consider public safety in addition to simply the consideration of, under a case named Van Atta, simply the consideration that will the person return to court. Then the court got to consider public safety. And that has been an evolving principle here in California with some dramatic evolutions here in 2017 and 2018 that I know we'll be talking about tonight.
And it seems from my own experience as a defense attorney that the public safety aspect, at least in some of the counties in which I practice, it's really taken over, and that's everything else has become secondary until recently. Jeff Adachi, welcome. What do you have to say about just definitionally where we are right now up until the beginning of this year?
Well, I mean, in San Francisco, you know, we've seen sky-high bails for many years. And the way it works is that there's a bail schedule that every county, the judges get together and figure out what the amount of the bails are. And it's basically just a piece of paper that says charge A, the bail is $10,000, charge B, it's $20,000, charge C, and so on and so forth. And what's happened most recently is that they will take a person's charge sheet, simply add up the bail on every charge, and you have this, you know, huge amount. You know, $200,000 to $300,000 is the typical bail in San Francisco. We've even had $20-25 million bails in cases. Steve, I think you got a $34 million bail.
That's the woman who was out posted $64 million because it was done part property bond.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, you're talking about not an insurance policy, but one that people can't afford to pay, and that's a problem. And most of our clients are poor public defenders. Many of the people who find themselves in the criminal justice system are poor, and so they just end up, you know, being housed at the local jail, you know, for however long it takes for their case to be resolved. And if you have money, you can get out of jail. Bernie Madoff was out on bail. He could afford to pay his own security detail, but for, you know, the average person. And then the thing that really drives us crazy is that often a person is arrested, right? There's a bail set, they'll post a bail, and the charges are dismissed by the DA. We had one client who had put up basically $20,000 and was committed to pay this over a period of 5 years and still paying to this day payments. because she got into an argument with a family member at Thanksgiving and was charged with domestic violence. So, well, the case was never filed, but she paid the bail and she's on the hook.
So let's go back just a little bit. We've talked about a little about what bail is. Who would like to tell what's right about the bail system? Corinne, do you want to field that?
Sure. What's right about the bail system? Well, my father started in the bail bond business in 1968. And in 1968, the bail profession and bail was much different from the way it is now. Back then, it was more about, you know, being in part of your community, being there for fellow members of your community. When someone would get arrested, they would call you. 9 times out of 10, you may know that person, or you may know that person through, you know, a couple other people or through the community. And you were really bailing out people in your community, people that you know you would see at the grocery store on Saturday or Sunday morning, what have you. And that's the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to... Well, I don't know if it's supposed to be, but that's the way it all started. And the way it is now is it's quite different. We have more of the sort of the conglomerate type of bail bonds, and it's sort of more based on numbers and volume and how many people you can bail out rather than just the quality of the person. And, you know, I believe that the bail schedules have just become incredibly too high, and you know, and I think one of the reasons why they've become so high is because of the turn that the bail community has taken.
So, for poor folks,
yeah,
what you're finding is that these high bails are preventative detention, and they may be locked up for a long time. Whereas for wealthy folks, they could do horrific things, and it's a ticket out. Is that kind of what I'm getting from you guys, that no matter what a wealthy enough person has done, they can bail out, and no matter how minuscule the allegations may be against a poor person, they're probably in for the long haul until they get to their resolution of their case?
Right. And the way the laws are written, the bail agent is responsible to collect 10%, and the money that is paid to the bail agent is considered paid in full upon the moment you are released from jail, which has absolutely nothing to do with the outcome of their case. So Jeff Adachi is right when he says that the case could get dropped and they will still owe the bond company, because that's the way the law is written. And it's unfortunate, because a lot of people are responsible for paying high bail amounts and money that they honestly can't afford to lose.
So we're talking about bail and bail reform. And if you wish to ask a question of our guests, our number is 866-798-8255. And before we go further, I want to give each of you gentlemen a chance to weigh in if you see other problems with the bail system as it exists now. And if we'll pass for a moment the recent changes of the last couple months, and then we'll get to that.
I mean, you know, there's only two countries that have a for-profit bail system, the United States and the Philippines. And there's probably a reason for that. It's just something that we shouldn't have in a civilized society. I mean, there are other indicators which can guarantee a person's appearance at court. Look at how many times they've shown up to court in the past and how many times they failed to appear and what your family contacts are and, you know, sort of, you know, your community ties, your employment, you know, there's a whole number of things that the court can look at. So they've started using what's called a formula algorithm, which is basically a calculation of a person's chance of showing up to court. And we think that that's a better way, at least to use as a tool, than just the amount of money that a person has.
And Steve?
And this is one of those occasions that's worthy of marking historically that Jeff Adachi and I agree. That because I also am, and to my knowledge, I'm the only elected district attorney in the state so far, I share the view. I think the money bail system has long passed its usefulness in the state of California, both for the reasons that Jeff mentions about poor people not being able to post and people being kept in on low-level crimes on $5,000 bail that they can't make, and particularly in a county like mine, San Mateo County, where we've got people who are posted bails of $500,000, a million, and the big one that we mentioned a moment ago, a woman who's posted $64 million bail, while the person that my office is accused of being her accomplice in the murder is in custody because he can't post that bail. And that's not right. And that's why I've taken the position that the publicly and been a crusader on it, that the money bail system should be ended, that it should be replaced. This is not new to us. We have done this in our juvenile court system forever. There's no money bail in juvenile court. It is based entirely on a consideration of factors such as Jeff mentioned. I think it ought to change. There's legislation going through that I know we'll talk about later in the show, but I don't think that accomplishes the end. It still has money bail, and that's unfair. And simply because you are rich, because you might have money, that shouldn't get you out while somebody else doing similar conduct, they have to stay in. I view that as wrong. I would much rather have it where people will simply, a judge, I want discretion with our judges, but I want it to be based on whatever the appropriate assessment tool is, and then make reasoned choices in or not in. And if they do say they can be out, the judges can condition it on all sorts of things. They can condition it on staying at home, putting on ankle bracelets, whatever it may be that fits for the circumstances. That's what I think is the right system to go. And I'm actually, in my crusade, getting some of my fellow DAs to stop and think about it a little bit rather than where we have been, which is keeping it. I think it's time for a change. And I hope when you get people like Jeff and I both saying and Corinne saying it's time for that, I'm kind of hopeful people will listen and this might happen.
Well, before we get there, Corinne hasn't said quite that she's there yet. I'm going to turn to you in just a minute, Corinne, and give you a chance to respond. But before I do, William in Belvedere, you're on Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. By coincidence, in Marin County, we're having a district attorney's election coming. It's an open seat now. And one of the candidates, Anna Pletcher, who's a federal prosecutor, but she's running for district attorney in Marin, she's drawn attention to a particular aspect of this problem. And that aspect is that because a poor person has to remain in jail, they may very often plead to something lesser than that of which they're accused just to get out of jail, so that they won't lose their job or be separated from their family, etc. And they may never have committed the crime at all, but they just, to get back to their lives and their families, if they can't afford the bail, they plead guilty. And that's a terrible thing.
The rich get richer, the poor get prison. Thank you, William. That's a very valid point. I know Jeff wants to jump in with a response as well, and I'll turn it to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true from my experience. What happens is that a person who's in jail and can't afford to post bail, the only thing that they can afford to do is plead guilty. And if they plead guilty, then and get a sentence where they're going to be released shortly or be released, you know, that day, they'll do so. And it doesn't promote reliability in the criminal justice system because you have really two systems, you know, one for people who can't afford to get out and one, you know, for people who are essentially coerced into pleading guilty because they can't afford to post bail. And this is a very common phenomenon that we see.
Do you agree?
No, I actually think he's right, but I also know what type of an attorney he is. And I'm sure, Jeff, you do a great deal to try and convince the client not to do that, because if you know a case where you might win that at trial, you might push that. But you know one of the big problems, I think? It's not our topic, but because it's taking so long for cases to get to trial, that pressure just mounts. And that if we had a system that moved more quickly, I think then there would be less, not eliminate, but be less of what you describe.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I mean, the judges and prosecutors, they know that a person is more likely to plead guilty when they're in. And so they're going to use that leverage. And often the person, you know, is going to lose their job. They're going to lose their house. And, you know, they're desperate. And so they'll take a deal and plead guilty.
Hopefully those days where there were certain bench officers that kept people in custody in order to get the pleas going and the cases moving, hopefully those days are waning, if not gone. But we're going to pause for a moment. You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this. Once again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight is bail reform and money bail. My guests in the studio tonight are Jeff Adachi, the public defender of San Francisco, Steve Wagstaff, the district attorney of San Mateo County, and Corinne Rankin, the former board chairman from the California Bail Agents Association. And where we left off, we were talking about the bail system and what's wrong with it. Corinne's about to tell us if she agrees with those statements attributed to her, that she's ready to scrap it too. I don't think that's the case. We'll hear from her in a moment. But if you have questions for my guests, you can call us here in the studio at 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling outside the local dialing area, call 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Corinne, as a judge I appeared in front of frequently, used to say, what say you?
I'm not in favor of scrapping the bail system entirely. I'm a firm believer in the bail system. There's a certain amount of freedom that comes with a person having the ability to be in control of their own freedom. Going with the proposed system and having to go through an algorithm, and you know, you'll essentially be in the system and on probation before you've even been found guilty of a crime. I mean, if you're accused of a crime and then you have a probation officer and you're wearing an ankle monitor and you have to check in and maybe you have to do a drug test, you know, with all of these restrictions, be home at a certain hour, that's not freedom. That's not innocent until you're proven guilty. That's guilty. And then you have to fight for your innocence. So that's the opposite of, you know, what this country is. And Jeff said earlier that, you know, the United States and the Philippines are the only ones that do this. Well, I'm a firm believer that here in America, we let people be in charge of their own freedom. And not having a money bail system takes that away completely.
Now, one of the things I would like to get to are what can be done to reform the system. And I'll come to you first about that. But before we do, there have been some recent, pretty dramatic changes in the last few months. And Jeff, I'll turn to you to talk about those because your office is really at the front, the leading edge of what's spearheading those reforms.
Well, we partnered with the Civil Rights Corps, which is a nonprofit organization that is committed to bringing lawsuits and actions challenging the bail system. And the result of our collaboration with them is a case called the Humphrey case. Kenneth Humphrey is a elderly individual who was charged with stealing $3 and a bottle of cologne, and was charged with residential robbery. And as a result, the bail was set at $600,000 in his case. And so we filed an appeal to the Court of Appeal, and the court ordered the judge to hold a bail hearing, which the judge did, and the judge reduced it to $300,000 or $350,000. And the court said, well, wait a minute, you know, how did you come to that number? And essentially, you know, the judge relied on the bail schedule. As I mentioned before, it's just a piece of paper with some numbers on it, and didn't make an individualized determination as to what Mr. Humphrey could afford. Mr. Humphrey hadn't had any prior convictions for 11 years, and, you know, there's really no justification for setting bail that high. And so ultimately, the court reversed the judge again, sent the case back, and said, you're going to have to hold a constitutionally required hearing. And you have to consider Mr. Humphrey's ability to pay. You have to consider other alternatives. And for, you know, Mr. Humphrey had been in custody for a year at this point, awaiting trial. And so, you know, we were able to show that he had a place to live, that he would pose no public danger, and that he was willing to wear a ankle bracelet. And Mr. Humphrey was more than happy to accept those conditions and was released. He was just released last week after being in prison for a year. And, of course, he hadn't been convicted of anything yet. And so that in that case, the Court of Appeal found that bail is a tax on the poor. That's the language that they used. And so this has really not only affected Mr. Humphrey's case, but because this decision was decided by the Court of Appeal, it is now the law of California and has to be followed everywhere. And so what's known as a Humphrey hearing is now required in every jurisdiction.
And this is just a fairly recent phenomenon in the last few weeks or last few months. But my understanding of the law before, and I expect both of you will jump in if I'm wrong, is that if the court can guarantee appearance or has reasonable guarantees of appearance and that public safety can be preserved, they should be setting – releasing the person on their own recognizance. And in the event those two things aren't met, they should be setting bail. And what Humphrey really adds to the game is that the court needs to consider alternatives to bail and the person's ability to pay in
That's
setting
right.
bail.
Right.
It isn't what works with the bail system premised somewhat on having a stake in the game?
Yes. Yes, it is. When a person has to put in their own finances, it makes them appreciate one their freedom more because they've paid for it and they've earned it, and it does make them more accountable. When you're purchasing, an insurance policy, it's just like car insurance. If you have to pay your car insurance every month, you're going to be a much more careful driver rather than if you didn't. That's why there's a law that everyone has to have car insurance. My question in regards to the pretrial program and the algorithms is, if a person is forced to wear an ankle monitor for a year while they're going through their court proceedings, is that going to count as time served? Is it going to be credit towards time served? Because that's one of the questions that a lot of people have in the community. And what I've been hearing is that it's not.
That's true. It's not. I mean, because you're not in jail. And if you're wearing an ankle bracelet, it's not considered equivalent of being in custody. As a community, we have to think, is it better off to have somebody on an ankle bracelet or better off to have them in custody? I saw in San Mateo the cost of incarcerating somebody for a year is $75,000.
Yes.
That's a lot of money. And so it makes sense that rather than to keep somebody in jail just because they can't afford to post bail, like Mr. Humphrey, it makes more sense that he's now in a treatment program. He wants to be there. He's made the decision to be there rather than to sit in jail. He has access to services and treatment and medication. And it's a better thing for society overall that he is not in jail and that he, is able to enjoy his freedom while he fights his case. It's also helpful if you're facing a charge to be out of custody, because you can work on your own case, you can investigate your own case, you can be more active, in the defense. And up until now, only wealthy defendants, would have that ability to be able to, work with their lawyers and see their lawyers on the outside rather than on the inside where your options are very limited.
I agree with that. But what's very important, and it's still true under Humphrey, because what we're seeing in the system is prosecutors bringing our own Humphrey motions based on the fact of public safety and asking for the preventative detention. And courts are throughout the state of California are wrestling with that detail and that component that was in Humphrey. And the question, it's going to be unresolved. There's still lots of case law to come on this. And Humphrey itself, the Supreme Court may weigh in on that. But I'm thinking of what occurred earlier today in the case that's received a great deal of notoriety up in Solano County, Fairfield, of the couple that's charged with the abuse of the 10 children on that line. And they held a Humphrey hearing today. And in that hearing, what the judge, according to the news reports I heard, ruled is that while they may not be a danger to the public at large, they are a danger to those 10 children, and then denied it because of the danger to the 10 children. Things like that are going to get appellate review as to whether that is a valid consideration or not. So we've still got a lot to learn. But that component of Humphrey is one that prosecutors, including in my County are embracing as, yes, there are occasions people should get out. Mr. Humphrey is maybe the example. And then there are going to be others where we're saying this person is a danger to the community if released and there should be preventative detention. So it is a fair tool for both sides to try and bring to the judge, for the judge to make the fair and equitable decision.
One of the trends I see in the industry for bail bonds is some of the bond companies are starting to move towards partnering with electronic monitoring companies, various other implements that can be used in that regard. Corinne, I see you were nodding. Do you have some input on that for us?
I do know several bail agencies who have begun to venture into that field. Myself, I was not one of them. I haven't been a licensed bail agent now for a little over a year.
But with that trend taking place,
it is happening. It's happening, and you know, it's a good thing. You know, I encourage bail agents to sort of, think outside the box. I think we all do think outside the box. If, you know, being a bail agent, we always got a bad rap, but it is in a lot of aspects, it's a noble profession. It's not certainly not for everyone, but it is. It makes you really responsible to your community, and it's a noble profession. So, like I said, there are bail agents in certain counties that have really been working in partnerships with the counties to implement the ankle monitor and the pretrial release. I've even traveled to New Orleans, and I've seen visited with bond companies there who have in contracts with the sheriff's office, and they're releasing people on ankle monitors.
You know, there's an additional aspect to this, and that is that there are some counties. I know San Francisco and Mr. Dachi and his county have developed some programs there. There is in Santa Clara County seems to be one that gets they've set up an entire pretrial release department independent of everybody. And they're the ones who've been testifying before the legislature, been held up as sort of the model of what's going on. And they use a risk assessment tool, and they're conducting that sort of a thing. Here's the trouble. In many of the urban counties, they can afford that. The issue is when you get out to Modoc County, Humboldt County, or down to Imperial County, where they don't have the resources that do, the state's going to have to come through with money to make this work, because it really does require a risk assessment tool that's effective.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that ultimately the legislature has to act. There needs to be a fix that is going to allow every county to implement the principles of Humphrey. And also ensure public safety by having an agency, an independent agency, that is able to provide supervision. The feds do it. They have a smaller caseload than we do, but they have been effective at being able to monitor people.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights, where our topic tonight is bail reform, and we'll be returning right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight is bail reform and the topic of money bail. My guest in the studio tonight, need little introduction, Steve Wagstaff, the San Mateo County District Attorney, Corinne Rankin, the recent chair of the board for the California Bail Agents Association, and Jeff Adachi, the public defender of San Francisco. We're talking about bail reform, or maybe scrapping bail. Before we get to that point, even today, there's some alternatives to bail bonds. Does anybody wish to take that up, some of the alternatives that might exist?
Well, I think that probably the most common, because California is really behind the ball when it comes to bail reform. Kentucky, Indiana, Maryland have all enacted bail reform. New Jersey. And most have looked at a system where they consider, again, other factors, objective factors in determining whether or not a person should be released, looking at whether they failed to show up to court before, whether they have a good job, whether they have housing, whether they've been in trouble before. And they often use what's called an algorithm, which is a fancy word for a formula, and they plug this information in, and it provides the judge with a recommendation as to whether to release a person or not. Now, one of the problems is that often the judge doesn't follow the recommendation, and we've seen that in about 40% in San Francisco, and that is what was happening before the Humphrey decision that we discussed in the last segment. Under Humphrey now, because I think judges are aware of their obligation to only consider bail as sort of a last alternative, we've actually seen a reduction of high bails, and we've seen more people getting out. When we compare the first 3 months of January, February, and March of last year to this year, you know, since the Humphrey case has been decided, we had a 40% increase in the number of people who were being released on what they call their own recognizance or their promise to appear. The other thing we've been doing in San Francisco is that we started what's called a pretrial release unit, and we have attorneys available as soon as a person is booked. So you're getting booked for a crime. That means you're being placed in jail.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. Well, you never know. And there you have a public defender. And if you were a wealthy person, you'd have that same access. So we have two attorneys and one investigator who are essentially assigned to the jail, and they interview people, they validate information, and they even provide some investigation. And so there was a story in the Chronicle today about a veteran who was arrested, 76 years old, who's charged with domestic violence. Turns out he was the victim. And the pretrial release unit was able to figure that out, and the district attorney ended up charging the victim in that case with the crime and letting him go. We've also had cases where individuals have been charged with crimes, and we went out and got the video, and it turns out that they're, again, either innocent or the victim. So it's helpful to have, you know, that resource there. We also have a bail unit, and we file bail motions, which are formal hearings in every case, and many public defender offices and defense attorneys don't do that, and we do in every case.
You know, even within the system that we have now for bail, there are some alternatives to posting cash or to posting a bail bond. I don't know if you want to take that up, Corinne, but
you mean a property bond?
That would be one example. Yes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I was not in the business of doing property bonds. That's probably more of Jeff's area. But what I would hear from a lot of clients is that the reason why they would opt for a bail bond is because in most counties, a property bond took too long. It would take up to about 30 days at a minimum to get a property bond. So a lot of people would just opt to go to a bail bond.
And you used to have twice the value of the bail. So if your bail was $200,000, you'd have to have, you know, $400,000 in a property value in equity,
which is still a bigger problem in parts of the state, maybe less so locally.
And part of what I view is the problem. And that's why people can, who have the money, the wealthy, they get out because they do have the property with the equity, and that's the unfairness that I think needs a remedy.
Yeah, bail is just, it's not affordable. It used to be, you know, when you get stopped for or get arrested for, you know, possession of a controlled substance. I remember San Francisco, early 2002, 2003, it was $5,000. So it was not a hardship on a family to come up with $500. You know, they'd put $250 down. The next month, they'd pay another $250, and it was, you know, sort of money that they could, you know, maybe afford to lose. If it wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't have to move out of their home for the $500. But the way it is now in San Francisco, possession of a controlled substance is $100,000. So that's a really big difference, and that's why I feel like Jeff advocates so much for the, you know, no money bail, because it's no longer reasonable. In my view, my opinion, or affordable.
You know, I think it's worth mentioning that this isn't just people such as Jeff and myself who have taken this position. The Chief Justice of California appointed a commission that comprised of judges, and they spent a year, probably 20 people on it. I addressed them, and they spent a year and came up with a report studying those other states. noting places like Kentucky, where it's not new. Kentucky went to their system in 1970 and have had it working for years. And their recommendation that was submitted to the Chief Justice and then to the government was that we should be abandoning bail and going forward to a non-money bail system. And when you have the judiciary of this state taking that position, along with people in the executive branch, I think it's worth listening to. The only issue that's bothering a lot of people in the, I think, in the governor's office and other in the legislature is what we mentioned earlier. Well, they're going to have to spend some money on that, and they may want to spend that money some other project they've got. But I think this is so significant a component of criminal justice. That's why I think they ought to listen to the Chief Justice's commission on it.
And they estimate that the cost of bail to the public is somewhere around $150 million a year that's, you know, being spent throughout the state. That's a lot of money. And it primarily hits communities of color. I mean, when you look at who's paying the bails, and by bail, I'm not talking to people who can post their bail and get out, but people who are paying the non-refundable 10%. Most are people of color. That's certainly the case in San Francisco. And so you have certain communities that are disproportionately affected, you know, by having to pay these bail premiums. And often the way it works is that the person will put down a down payment and then they'll be on the hook, you know, for the remainder, which can be tens of thousands of dollars forever. And they then have to pay an interest premium on that if they're, you know, paying either in payments or over a period of time, and that's going to even increase the cost.
Well, there's no interest. That's the Department of Insurance doesn't allow us to charge interest. I say us form. I still use the term us and we, but no. So the law is that we can't charge interest. We can only charge 10%, not a penny more.
But if the people borrow money elsewhere, they're going to hit interest.
Exactly.
And they have the loss of use, presumably, which might have generated some income. But
true.
With that in mind, it's interesting from where I'm sitting now, hearing from such different perspectives where presumably, Jeff, you would be concerned about people that can't get out, and Steve, you would be concerned about people who can get out, but that ultimately you reach the same conclusion from different perspectives, which is interesting to hear. One of the things we haven't talked about is some of the costs that would be incurred by moving away from the bail system. And what I'm going to ask in a moment that you talk to some of those, but for our listeners, if you have questions for our guests, our number here in the studio is 415-841-4134, or if you're outside the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. One of the costs that we haven't talked about is the cost of doing a pretrial assessment. And in juvenile court, for example, there are significant resources dedicated to looking at the numbers of children that are coming into the system, which are much smaller than the number of adults, and really doing an in-depth analysis on each and every one of them, on each and every case, to make that determination. And we haven't put those type of resources into adult probation. Do we have any idea what would be required and what those costs might be?
Well, I mean, we have a pretrial service agency in San Francisco called Pretrial Diversion. And as far as I know, I think their budget is somewhere around, you know, $1 million or $1.5 million. And they do assessments in almost every case. And they, you know, put together a report that goes to a judge, and that report has things on it like, you know, whether the person has a job and they're standing in the community and relatives that they have in the area, and they try to validate information for the judge. Now, the pretrial services also has a special program where they actually provide supervision, meaning that they make sure the person gets back to court, that they contact them. In other words, the person on supervision has to contact them 3 times a week, has to check in, and they even have programs that some people have to go through. So given all of that, you know, we feel that it can be done, but it is going to cost money because there are some, as Steve said, there are some jurisdictions that don't have the funding to do this, and so there needs to be funding allocated. But that would be offset by, you know, the savings that counties would realize by increasing the number of people that they would place on supervised release, for example.
I agree with that. I am curious what it does. In that article you referenced earlier, Jeff, in the Chronicle today, at the end of it, they were talking about all the bed days that had been saved. But they said the population in the jail hadn't really dropped. They never explained why that is. Do you know why that is?
Well, actually, the population has dropped. If you look at over the last 5 years, for example, our prison jail population in San Francisco was always around 2,400. Now it's down to about 1,200. But what's happened is that that number hasn't changed, and that number has been constant for the last 2 years. And the reason why is that 80% of the jail days come from people who are there long term. And even though you have more people who are cycling in and out of jail, you know, for, you know, what is it, the 20% of the daily jail population, you know, that's constantly cycling in or out, you still have that core, you know, of people who are using the jail beds 80% of the time. And those are people who are in longer periods of time. So I think when we look at these programs, we have to look at the success of you know, saving jail beds against the population of folks who are cycling in and out of the jail, if that makes sense.
It does. I agree with that.
I see TJ from Walnut Creek. You're on the line. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. Thank you for having this conversation. I think it's very critical. I do have one question regarding balances owed in terms of bail bonds or bail. When a defendant is found not guilty, do they ever receive any portion of money that they put up for bail? Is any portion of it refunded? I think it's just something that not many people are aware of, if that happens or not.
Only in your dreams. You don't get a penny back. You could, you know, be in trial for murder, you know, post a bail, be out on bail. You can spend tons of money on your lawyer, and you're found not guilty or you're found innocent, and, you know, you don't get anything in return. I mean, the only exception is that if you've been exonerated and incarcerated for a period of time, then there's a statute that gives you a certain amount of compensation. But no, you don't get anything back. And that's one of the problems, because people who are arrested and have their cases dismissed. I mean, I mentioned the person earlier who, you know, had their charge dismissed within days. The district attorney didn't even file the case. That person was still on the hook to pay bail. And that's one of the problems, is that, you know, you're not going to be made whole. And in fact, you'll be pushed further into debt, regardless of whether you're guilty or innocent, and regardless of whether the district attorney decides to file a case against you.
As Corinne pointed out, bail is an insurance policy.
It's an insurance policy. So you're paying to, you know, be released from jail, and it's insurance. So it's much like your car insurance. You pay your car insurance premium for the year, and at the end of the year, you can't go back to your insurance company and say, "Hey, I didn't get in an accident. Can I have some of my money back?" It's the same sort of insurance-type rules apply.
TJ, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this. And thank you all for joining us, and for those who have donated to KALW to keep this show going. Where we left off is we were talking about some of the costs that are implicit in the system that we're hearing you advocate for, in terms of working on an algorithm, working on a predictive tool to make sure that the public is safe, that the person returns to court rather than bail. One of the costs we didn't talk about and anticipate possibly some pushback from the local judiciaries, is there any likelihood that if people are not in custody, they're actually free to fight their cases, and hence we need to put more into the judicial budget? Does anybody want to talk to that?
I will. That's balderdash. That's what they're there for. And if any judge had the gumption to articulate that out loud, I would say that's nonsense. That cannot be a consideration. That is saying justice moves down the list of priorities in favor of expediency, and I'm never a believer in that.
Yeah, the studies have actually showed that if you're in custody, regardless of the strength of the evidence against you, that you're more likely to plead guilty, and you're actually more likely to get jail time. And you think about it, it sort of makes sense. If you're not in jail and you're fighting your case, you're able to make a better, you know, case for yourself that you should be out. You can, you know, go to school. You can, you know, make positive changes in your life, which then can help your sentence. If you're in jail, you're very limited in terms of what you can do. And again, you know, most of the people who are in jail, they're for nonviolent offenses. Many of the people who are in custody are there for, you know, misdemeanor crimes. And so, you know, what is the logic behind keeping somebody in jail, you know, if they're not a threat to society, if, you know, they can successfully live outside and fight their case?
With that, let's move on and talk about proposals for reform, either reforming the current system or really get more in depth about what you're each proposing. Given that you're anticipating or looking for potentially different results, I don't know if you're sharing the same vision for where things are going. I think, Corinne, you have a little different vision as to where things should be. Who would like to start out? Talk to us a little bit about putting some meat on the bones. What would you really like to see happen?
Well, I think it's good for your audience to be able to hear about what is going through our legislature right now. It's SB 10, and it's getting down to a critical time in negotiation. I know the state DAs have been working with Senator Hertzberg's office, the sponsor of it, and I'm sure the state public defenders have too, as to what ought to be involved. And that one maintains the money bail system. That doesn't do what Jeff and I believe would be the best step. And it's, as is typical of the political process in the legislature, it's being hammered out, and there's give and take, and principle has to fall to the needs of each side. But what that would do essentially is say that you consider all these other factors in the court in setting bail, but it maintains the money bail system. It maintains individual bail schedules in individual counties. It doesn't set up a statewide bail schedule. And it has, on the latest discussion, they've been talking about what crimes will be excluded for it. There have been some requests made by, I know, prosecutors, that excluded from consideration of this new process would be any serious or violent crime. Which is a substantial number.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. You mentioned bail schedules. We've talked about that throughout the night. But you mentioned a statewide bail schedule. Can you describe a little to our listeners what that means?
Well, it would be a statewide bail schedule rather than each individual county having its own schedule. And they do vary. The schedules would vary from San Francisco to San Mateo. The schedules will vary, and it's throughout the 58. And there has been much discussion over the year about having a statewide bail commission who would set a standard bail schedule for all 58 counties. It's never gained any traction. And I don't know of anybody now suggesting that occur.
I'd just like to add that it was Assemblyman Kirk Hagman back in 2011, and he is a bail bondsman, and he was also an assemblyman, and he proposed this because it was something that the bail industry saw, that the bail schedules were getting way too high, way too unobtainable for our clients. And so Assemblyman Hagman, back in 2011, proposed the statewide bail schedule. And you're right, it didn't gain any traction back then.
And, you know, I think that if we're going to have real bail reform in California, you know, we have to eliminate money bail completely. And that's not happening right now through the legislature. And so we have to have this debate. You know, there's going to be a lot of opposition to the proposal that has been put out there. You know, the courts and the judges have their views. And, you know, in my opinion, the judges have not been supportive of bail reform. They're addicted to the money bail system. And it's very hard to get them away from that. They ultimately want to be able to decide whether to keep someone in or not. And if you agree that judges should have the discretion to decide that, the question still becomes, you know, whether or not money bail is something that, you know, should even be part of the system. If you always have money bail as a default, people who have money are still going to be able to buy their freedom, right? Even if you're charged with murder, you can buy your freedom. And that's not the way our system is supposed to work. It's, you know, the saying injustice liberty and justice for all has to mean something. And that means that a person without money has the same chance at justice than a person with money.
I think I certainly agree with the principle you state. I do think that our state judiciary does have a feeling that the right way to go would be away from money bail. That was their proposal. That was they issued over 100-page report that went into detail about it and really did urge, and has been presented to the governor, that this is going to the no-money bail system. Now, on the individual counties and their trial judges with the calendars, there may be some different feeling, but certainly the leaders of the judiciary have expressed this view, and the roadblock that I know they keep hearing, the same one we've heard, which is, oh, we don't want to spend the money on that. We'd rather spend it on some other state project. And I think this is a crucial item the state ought to pay attention to.
And to that end, I can tell you from my observations, when other entities are looking for money, they will trump out whoever it is that's losing that resource, whether it is the disadvantaged or somebody who has a medical problem, whatever it is, they don't want their budgets cut. They put people in the halls of the legislature to ask for money and to say, you can't cut us. The courts have not always been as effective at doing that. So some of the resources that the court would look to may not be there as much as we would like. But as we're reaching the top of the hour, I'd like to give you each about a minute or so if there's something you want to say in summary. And Jeff, we'll start with you.
Well, the governor's going to have the ultimate say. And, you know, of course, his term is coming to an end. And if there's any one legacy that Governor Brown can leave, it is fixing this bail problem. It's something that, you know, has plagued our justice system for many years. I think people are now in agreement that there's a problem. No one's denying there's a problem. Well, the District Attorneys Association, somewhat. But, you know, and I really appreciate that Steve, you know, is taking the position that he is. And hopefully more district attorneys will come along. And even the bail industry, and like Corinne said, I mean, in the past, we have worked together. The problem is that when we're talking about the systematic change, I realize that it's going to create a problem for the bail bonds industry, but they will shift and they will find other ways to make a living other than by charging a premium against poor people who can't otherwise afford to get out. So what I'm hoping is that we will see bail reform this year in 2018, and that the good people of California will let their politicians know loud and clear that this is something they want to see.
Corinne, would you like to sum up?
I would not like to see the money bail system go away. And I say that as a former bondsman. I haven't held a license in over a year. I would like to see that, you know, the system become more affordable. The bail should be affordable to each individual, and because they have a right. And like I said, there's a reason why our country does this, and that's because this is true freedom. I mean, we cannot easily give up this right and just, you know, give it over to, you know, your county and your government officials to be the sole person in charge of your freedom. I would rather have a bail that I can't obtain and work towards obtaining that bail than to have to rely solely on the government to decide that I can be free or I'll be in jail.
Steve, I'll give you the last word.
Our criminal justice system, our entire justice system, is based on fairness and equity. And in my view, having watched it for all these decades, I think there is an inequity that has evolved over recent years, and it needs to change. Yeah. And my belief that change is by coming about is ending money bail, where everybody who stands in front, prince or pauper, what you get is fairness from the judge. And I think the only way to accomplish that is to end money bail, and that's why I support that.
Thank you. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. I'd like to thank all three of you for joining us. We've been talking about bail reform and money bail. My guests tonight have been Jeff Adachi, the Public Defender of San Francisco, Steve Wagstaff, the District Attorney of San Mateo County, and Corinne Rankin, former bail agent, former chair of the board of the California Bail Agents Association. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Jeff Hayden. I'd like to thank also at production, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. We'll be back next week. This is Jeff Hayden, and have a good night.